Coming up in the show, been a minute since we've seen world number one Jon Rahm. Hear why his break from the game was important both on and off the course as he returns to action at the Century Tournament of Champions. And speaking of breaks, the last time we saw Patrick Cantlay, he was winning the biggest prize in professional golf, the FedEx Cup. What does Cantlay have in store for an encore coming off his four-win PGA Tour Player of the Year season? And it's the first week of January, so you gotta know what that means. Our way too early major prediction coming your way as Golf Today starts right now.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet.
You're in Hawaii early January, you're thinking extended vacation, wake up late, have a nice breakfast, toes in the sand, kick back and relax. Not so if you're Phil Mickelson on the range grinding early at the Plantation course. Mickelson off at 7 a.m. local time for his Wednesday Pro-Am. Playing with Justin Thomas, you see JT also getting in some prep work, currently inside the top 10 in the world rankings at number 8. You know he wants to get off to a fast start in 2022 with Bones by his side, the new player caddy duo getting ready for the Century Tournament of Champions. Happy Wednesday and welcome inside our Golf Channel studios. I'm George Savarikas with Golf Channel contributor Eamon Lynch. This is Golf Today. Eamon, as a Midwest guy originally, this was always one of my favorite weeks of the year because then I could start counting down the days until the snow disappeared and I could start playing golf. But I always romanticize seeing the winners from the previous year getting to tee it up at Kapalua.
Yeah, we're used to seeing these beautiful sunsets from Hawaii, George. You don't actually see sunrise very often. And, you know, some of us are used to playing golf in the dark or feeling as though we do. So it's interesting to see these guys doing it. But Phil's actually about to tee off in the Pro-Am with my buddy Trey Wingo. So Phil better be awake because Trey's ball could go anywhere.
Definitely food for thought. And I mean, if you've been sleeping on the field that they have this year for the Century Tournament of Champions, 8 of the top 10 in the world. A lot of big names making this a destination and the place that they want to kick off their calendar year in 2022, including world number one, Jon Rahm. You look at his results in this event, has teed it up 4 times. That is 4 top 10 finishes, including that runner-up back in 2018. Let's hear from Rahm's press conference as he met with the media in Maui.
My goal is to beat it. My goal is always to do better each year, but you know it's hard to say because I've had such a consistent year and had one win, right? But I could tell you right now, I'll gladly take a bit more of inconsistency, but have more than one win, right? So it all depends on how you categorize it, and I could tell you at the end of the year how I think about it, right? On the sport we play on, it's hard to only count wins as successes, just because, you know, it's a sport where winning is, we all lack in that department except one man. And you can't just think about a second place as a loss, right? So it's kind of hard to tell you ahead of time, but obviously my goal and my mind is that I'm having a better year.
Do you enjoy having the number one target on your back, etc.? Like, is it something you focus on? Or obviously, you want to be number one, but do you enjoy the challenge of people coming at you?
Yeah. Well, it's still something you got to earn, right? Meaning, I'm as number one because of how I've played in the past. So if I want to stay here, I got to keep playing at that level, right? And trying to get better. At the end of the day, I focus on myself, right? I try to improve my game and improve my level of golf. And if I can do that and play the way I know I can play, everything else should take care of itself, right? I'm not thinking constantly, oh, you know, he's number two, or he's coming for me, I need to do this and that. No, I'm trying to play the best shot I can and hopefully win a tournament.
Jon Rahm off at 5:35 Eastern time on Thursday, playing alongside Xander Schauffele. So it'll be interesting to see how those two handle the Plantation course, round number one of the Century Tournament of Champions. Jon Rahm had a season statistically that was pretty much unmatched last season on the PGA Tour. What do you think his expectations should be going into 22? And I thought it was interesting what he said, where a runner-up finish shouldn't be considered a loss necessarily.
No, plus a withdrawal shouldn't be considered a win, because we keep hearing this argument that he basically won the Memorial tournament because he had a six-stroke lead and had to withdraw when he tested positive for COVID. But as we all know, if a six-stroke lead on Saturday night meant anything in this game, well, Greg Norman would have a green jacket instead of beclowning himself on behalf of the Crown Prince. But John Rahm's expectations this year ought to be and will be pretty high. His expectations this week, on the other hand, might be very different, because John Rahm hasn't played in now almost 3 months at this point, since he made a couple of stops in Europe at the end of last year. His last result was actually a missed cut over in Spain. So what John Rahm can expect of himself this week at the Century Championship, I think, should be calibrated a little bit lower than what his expectations are going to be for the rest of the year.
John always impresses me how introspective he is when it comes to meeting with the media and sharing his thoughts on how he views not just the game, but kind of how he balances now professional golf along with his family. But I do think the ultimate arbiter in determining greatness in professional golf is the amount of wins that you have. We don't look at Jack Nicklaus's resume and say, oh my God, 19 runner-up finishes in majors. That's incredible. It's he had 18 major victories. So golf hasn't gotten to the point like in baseball where you can have a pitcher who has an under 500 record, but because of his WAR, he wins the Cy Young. So I get why Patrick Cantlay not only is PGA Tour Player of the Year, but I think the next step for golf fans to see from John Rahm is for him to have a multi-win dominant type season.
And he's going out tomorrow with Xander Schauffele, another guy who can relate to this idea of actually coming up that little bit short all the time, being praised for your consistency, but it has to wear on you at a certain point if the consistency isn't actually delivering as many closings as you want when it comes to trophy day.
Well, a guy who certainly was able to close last season, that would be Patrick Cantlay. For more on the number four player in the world, we say aloha to Steve Burkowski. Burko, September 5th, 2021. I had to look it up. That was the last time we saw Patrick Cantlay. So how's he preparing for this week?
It certainly has been an extended break for Patrick, George. And let's get things clear here. There are no late wake-up calls in Hawaii when you're on the clock. So the toes in the sand, that's for those not working and playing golf here this week at Kapalua. But all seriousness, back to Patrick Cantlay. You guys just documented it. It was a career-defining year for the 29-year-old, who is now fourth in the official world golf ranking. And it, after those couple of wins to wrap things up at East Lake, he played in the Ryder Cup, but it has been more than 3 months since he's been back in competitive action. Caught up with Patrick yesterday to get his thoughts on moving forward in 22, but first asked him about looking back at what he accomplished a year ago.
I had some time to kind of think on it and digest, and you know, it was really just, I think, a result of my process. And so the plan for this year is just to double down on the process and do the things that are working and clean up the weaknesses in my game and kind of just keep charging forward.
We talked about a moment ago of you've had some downtime since the Ryder Cup. What have you been up to the last few months?
Yeah, just resting my body. I think, you know, it was a long year last year with six majors, and I felt like I played a lot. And so it was nice to just have some time off. And when I came back, I was excited to practice, which means I took enough time off.
You talk about the process. What did you prove to yourself in maybe validating all the hard work you've put into the game and getting to that highest level?
Yeah, I think golf's funny because you can play for so long and not win. And so when you do win, you need to appreciate it. And winning four times last year, you know, I really had some time to appreciate it. And not only that, just give me some validation that what I am working on are the right things.
What goals maybe have changed moving forward for you?
You know, I don't think about goals in an outcome-oriented way. I think about goals in a process-oriented way. And like I said, I feel like the process that I've set up is working. And so it really is as simple as doubling down on the processes that worked last year.
What's the process here this week to be successful in Maui?
Yeah, I think the golf course is tricky. I think there's a lot of tricky different shots with different lies and different winds and lots of elevation change. And so not playing stock shots and being more comfortable getting creative is really, really helpful around this golf course.
If there is an immediate goal for Patrick Cantlay, it's an attempt to win his third consecutive event on the PGA Tour. He's making his fourth start here this week at Maui. His best finish, he finished fourth back in 2020. That was a couple of years ago, George. And if it makes you feel better, maybe aiming as well, I'll get a little toes in the sand late afternoon. How about that?
There we go. A little happy hour, I'm hoping, for Steve Burkowski. All right, we'll check in with you again later in the show. The tale of the tape between John Rahm And Patrick Cantlay, with what they were able to do, not just you see in the 2021 season, Cantlay 4 wins, Rahm 1, but Rahm 15 top 10s. He said yesterday, I think asterisk, maybe a 16th top 10 for the Memorial. And you see what John did in majors, top 10 in all four with the win at the U.S. Open. So when we see the tail of the tape, what comes to mind?
I think when you look at that Player of the Year vote, there's evidence here, and we saw it a few years ago with Brooks Koepka and Rory McIlroy as well, in a year where Koepka won majors but Rory won the FedEx Cup, is players are tending to favour the consistency over a FedEx Cup than the 1 week of a major championship. It's not how a lot of fans look at it. It's not ultimately how the history books probably judge it, but there's a clear favourite in this race. I don't understand why people were so bent out of shape thinking that this was a close race. John Rahm had one trophy on his mantelpiece and Patrick Cantlay had four. To me, that's not even a contest for a Player of the Year vote, but the fact that Cantlay did not have a major championship seemed to get people pretty pent up over that vote.
No, it certainly did. I mean, and it was one that was well debated because the top 10 numbers that John put up were just so astronomical by comparison. But yeah. It'd be interesting to get Paige McKenzie's thoughts as we welcome in the third member of our team, Golf Channel analyst. Paige, I mean, how would you break down Rahm versus Cantlay, especially through the lens as a former player?
Well, I was going to say, first, this is makes me appreciate that the LPGA's Player of the Year is points-based. So it takes some objectivity into the equation rather than just the subjectivity of a vote. I always tend to kind of appreciate the players that have that kind of consistency, although I think it's impossible to argue with 4-1 in the win column. But that leads me to compare these two players in a different way. We know they're very different. The fire and ice is what I'll call it. The fiery Spaniard and Patty Ice in Patrick Cantlay. But let's look at the similarities of the two and how they got to where they are today. Both players were former number one in the world amateur golf ranking. Patrick Cantlay had the record at 55 weeks cumulatively, and then John Rahm took it over at 60 weeks. Both Bing Hogan and Jack Nicklaus award winners as, again, capstones to their amateur and collegiate careers. Both were low amateur in the U.S. Open on different years, and then both played some PGA Tour events as amateur, tied for ninth for Patrick Cantlay. He also had a 60 at the Travelers as an amateur when he played PGA Tour event. John Rahm's best finish was Waste Management in fifth place. Very similar number of starts, 121 starts, 113 starts for John Rahm. Both, incidentally, have made exactly 100 cuts so far. And you can see a slight pay difference in John Rahm's cash, a few more checks than Patrick Cantlay. The reason I bring this up is because we've so vividly followed John Rahm through his amateur career and into professional golf, and it was seamless. It was a very different story for Patrick Cantlay. He was out for nearly 3 years due to injury. There was a lot of fits and starts throughout the early part of his professional career, and he's now arrived to what I would consider is what most people would have expected him to do, given the accolades that he had as an amateur. So I think even though they're two very different characters on the golf course, it's amazing to see how many similarities in the fact that they both have six tour wins. And even though Patrick Cantlay's season in professional golf started sooner, they both had their first season in 2017, so mirrored each other in a lot of ways up until this point.
Paige, if you look at the resume of Patrick Cantlay, I'd say his performance in majors would be what's lacking and kind of what we would be looking for going forward. With John Rahm, he's won the U.S. Open. He's currently world number one. What would you say the next step is for his evolution?
For John Rahm's evolution, I think he pointed out exactly. Number one's not something to take for granted. He's got to continue to work because there's a lot of chasers coming after him. Patrick Cantlay, there's one thing that I've learned throughout, and that's listening to him in interviews. Incredibly thoughtful person. I know he's self-evaluated what he's done well and what he needs to work on. So I have no doubt that we'll continue to see the two of these players into 2022, hopefully in the same way that we saw them last season.
I loved what Patrick said, where he's like, I have Tiger's stoicism. I just don't know how to celebrate. Like, Tiger could turn it on and lose his mind for 3 seconds. He's like, I only have the ice part. I don't have the fire.
Well, he's getting a lot more practice and things to celebrate, George. So it'll probably come to him pretty soon.
I mean, I guess repetition helps down the road. All right, so coming up next, Our friend Bethann Nichols stops by for some bold predictions for the LPGA Tour in the new year. You don't want to miss what she has to say about 72-time LPGA Tour winner Annika Sorenstam. That's when Golf Today returns.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet. This season, don't just bet, live your bet life. And by WinGrips, the best grips in golf.
Back on Golf Today, the LPGA Tour returning to action January 20th, later this month, with the Hilton Grand Vacations Tournament of Champions at Lake Nona Golf and Country Club. There are some fantastic venues on the schedule in 2022. Let's take a look at some of those coming up. The Women's Major Championship venues, see the Chevron Championship, the grand finale at Mission Hills Country Club, 50 years coming to a close, U.S. Women's Open, returning to Pine Needles Lodge and Golf Club, KPMG Women's PGA Championship at Congressional, the Amundi Evian Championship, once again at Evian, and how about the AIG Women's Open being contested at Muirfield? So with more on the upcoming LPGA season, we welcome in Golf Week senior writer Bethann Nichols. Bethann, Happy New Year. Let's get right to it. What's the significance of the women playing Muirfield?
You know, I'm actually feeling the same way I did when the women were going to play the old course for the first time in 2007, where, of course, Lorena Ochoa won in stylish fashion, and the women were able to go into the R&A clubhouse for the first time. So it was a magical week in many ways, and a big sign of progress. And I think for a lot of players, young players, 2007 was a long time ago, and so this will be interesting for them to learn that the men have been playing major championships at Muirfield since the late 1800s, and the women are about to do it for the first time this summer. So, you know, there's a little bit of the, what took you so long, of course, since women only recently became members there as well, but a sign of progress and hope for the future. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Bethann, we're saying hello to Muirfield, but we're saying goodbye to Mission Hills out in Rancho Mirage after, 50 years? What are you hoping to see from the last appearance there?
You know, actually, now that you mention it, another Lorena Ochoa kind of party. That was one of my favorite wins was, when Lorena won and everybody seemingly jumped into Poppy's Pond. So, you know, I hope all the former champions of this great event come back for the week. And I actually wrote this in a column last year. I really hope they find a way to take the celebration to another level. And while they have all the past champions, all the greats there, celebrate the founders and put Shirley Spork into the LPGA Hall of Fame and celebrate her and the rest of the founders and allow her to accept that honor on behalf of all the founders who have already passed and put Lorena in as well. Like just live it up here. Let's do some things that are long overdue and celebrate what this venue has meant to the LPGA, this tournament. For 50 plus years.
Love the ideas, and I'd RSVP yes to that party well in advance. So now that we're at January 5th, New Year's resolutions are kind of out the window. It's time for bold predictions. So what's your bold prediction for 2022?
Well, sticking with the majors and another great, you know, I'm looking at Annika Sorenstam, and I'm thinking, how can she not play at Pine Needles? She has yet to officially commit to the event, though I understand from her husband that son Will is lobbying very hard that Annika plays. The only thing is that the following week is the tournament she hosts in Sweden, the Scandinavian mix with Henrik Stenson. So there's a little bit of a schedule thing, but I feel like she could easily pull off both events back to back. And I think she could make the cut, which sounds crazy because Annika last played in the US Open, of course, back in 2008 and famously hold out her final shot for Eagle, and as Annika would do. But, you know, when she made the cut last year at Nona, of course, it was her backyard, her home course, but players were saying that it was set up like a major championship. And of course, Annika has won at Pine Needles before, has tremendous memories there, was close friends with Peggy Kirk-Bell. And I think she could do it. I mean, what's the biggest test of a U.S. Women's Open is up here. And she recently won a major championship, for crying out loud.
Well, Bethanne, Amaka was part of the last rivalry we actually had in this sport, either men's or women's, with she and Carrie Webb going back 20 years at this point. We're on the cusp of another one now. Do you think we're going to see it with Nelly Korda and Jin Young Ko next year?
Gosh, I hope so. And I really see no reason why we can't, why we won't. I mean, last year it was a little unique in that you felt like they each owned half a season, and in that it was Nelly's for the beginning of the first half of 2021, and then Jin Young Ko the second half, and then they kind of merged there at the end in the final two events to see, you know, who would be player of the year. And I would love for it to be this back and forth throughout 2022. And I think we'll see both of them hoist major championship trophies. I think this will be fantastic for the tour, because I really don't think we'll see a player like an Annika or a Lorena win 8, 9, 10 times on the LPGA anymore. I think the talent is simply too deep globally. And so the next best thing, it is a rivalry. And I think that's what we're going to get.
Yeah, we've been saying the same thing on the PGA Tour. To see someone win 6, 8 times, it's just such a deep depth of field. So final question here before we let you go. Who will be your newsmaker of the year in 2022?
Well, you know, this is actually kind of breaking news in a way, in that Brooke Henderson is going to have to get a new driver. And Brooke Henderson is one of the most entertaining players on the LPGA. She, of course, grips down on her driver, grips down on all of her clubs, and is one of the longest, most aggressive players on tour. And she's going to have to go to a 46-inch driver because the LPGA is going to institute the model local rule, beginning with the what was formerly known as the Kia Classic, the JTBC in March. So it'll be interesting to see how this impacts Brooke, because of course she's a 10-time winner on the LPGA, and we're all expecting big things from her. And she's been using a long driver since she was 15 years old. So this will be a big adjustment for her. And unfortunately, we won't have the great shot link stats to really show us the nitty gritty details of how it all goes down for her in the coming months. But I'm really interested to see how this impacts her.
Yeah, it's definitely something to look at going forward, especially from a weight standpoint. The fact that she had choked down historically. So how much of an impact will those 2 inches be? Could be substantive. All right. Appreciate it, Bethanne.
Thank you.
All right. So Eamon, what do you make of the LPGA Tour deciding to follow in lockstep with kind of where professional golf is going, with that change from 48 to 46 inches being the maximum length?
It doesn't really surprise me. I mean, what surprised me a little bit was when the PGA Tour players actually voted for this, to adopt this local rule. It emanated from the players rather than the USGA handing it down. And I just watched that video of Brooke Henderson swinging. I mean, she was gripped down at least 3 inches on that driver, so maybe it actually won't have as much impact on her as we thought it was. I suspect that she will handle it in a much more quiet fashion than Phil Mickelson did when it was announced that the PGA Tour would adopt the same rule.
Let's bring in Paige once again. Paige, it's hard for me to understand, how does this improve professional golf by making this change?
That's a great question. I think the biggest thing is tone setting. And again, I'm not in charge of creating the rule. A USGA would probably be the best person to ask as it relates to what their intent is in allowing this as a local rule option, and then for the tours to be implementing it. But certainly it sets the tone from the manufacturer's side of it, that the standard that you're going to find on the rack that would be accessible to the vast majority of the public would stay at that 46-inch level. From the professional side, especially on the women's game, where they have not outgrown golf courses, it is a little bit of a head-scratcher as to whether they need to implement this or not. It certainly has a very direct impact on Brooke Henderson, who has widely been known to be playing a 46 or 48-inch driver the entirety of her career. So I think from that perspective, it feels a little bit like she's been singled out in this rule. However, Bethanne had reported in her article there was 7 reported players that this would affect, that do play drivers past 46 inches long. For Brooke Henderson, though, this has been her power play. She's ninth in driving distance on the LPGA Tour and third in overall driving. That includes accuracy. So Brooke Henderson has had an amazing amount of skill that's been required to keep that driver in control in the fairways. She's been able to capitalize it on it in a way that other players haven't attempted. Yes, she does grip down on it, but that is part of her counterbalance that's through the bag. I'm anxious to see how it's going to play out. Ultimately, with her, she's a very talented player. I think she'll adapt. But it is interesting that the LPGA has also chosen to adopt this rule starting in March.
And, Eamon, to your point, you said that the PGA Tour, the players voted on this.
Yep. But
the rule to even be crafted, just the optics for the average fan, it seems like that they're preeminently trying to solve a problem that doesn't quite exist yet. So, and it affects such a small portion of professional golfers in the men's and women's side. It's curious for me to understand what's the data that determines this is going to become such an issue that it needs to be addressed now.
Yeah, I think you're going to see a lot of instances where the governing bodies start to draw a line in the sand, even if it's quite a thin line at this point, in terms of trying to head off what they suspect might be coming down the road. We're not necessarily seeing the effects of that right now in terms of the longer equipment, but they've certainly seen enough to think that that might become the trend. We saw Bryson playing around with the idea of putting one of those drivers into play last year, which he didn't do.
Yeah, we only got to see a little flirtation with that in the World Long Drive Championship. Hello, hello. Welcome inside our Golf Channel studios. Always a great day if I'm sitting alongside Golf Week USA Today columnist and Golf Channel contributor Eamon Lynch. I'm George Savarikas, and you are joining us for the second hour of Golf Today. Excited later in the show to see those 2000 highlights from Tiger and Ernie. Last year, we had a playoff with Harris English and Joaquin Niemann at Kapalua. Something about that par 5 18th seems to lend itself to memorable finishes at the Tournament of Champions.
It really does, and they didn't come much more memorable than Tiger and Ernie going back 22 years at this point. But that was when it was the first tournament of the year. It's now actually the 10th tournament of the PGA Tour season. And some guys haven't even got their spikes on yet. Patrick Cantlay has not played a single tour event since he won the FedEx Cup. But I guess it takes a lot of time to count $15 million, George. But Bryson hasn't played one either. There's a lot of guys behind in the race.
I'm surprised that Cantlay didn't come back looking like Tom Hanks in Castaway after just 4 months on an island to just relax, enjoy the spoils of victory. So the PGA Tour resuming this week on Maui at the Century Tournament of Champions. Winners only from 2021 in the field. So with that in mind, let's welcome in our man on the ground this week who has been grinding up early. All work for Berko, no play. Brooks Koepka's been saying the right things about his game and his body the past 6 months, but his last top 10 in an official PGA Tour event, Berko, that came at the Open back in July. So what's his outlook like coming into 22?
Well, George, it's promising, according to Brooks Koepka. He's back in the field this week in Maui after winning the Waste Management Phoenix Open for the second time in his career. And we all remember that major championship run he had just a few years ago when he tallied 4 majors in about an 8-major tournament span. But we've seen a bit of a downtrend, if you will, from Brooks Koepka, mainly due to health issues and some injuries that he's battled for the past year or two. I caught up with Brooks yesterday where he talked about his health, his plans for 2022, and maybe most importantly, what he learned that might serve him well moving forward.
I think it's pretty easy for me to stay healthy. I think that's one of the big things. For the last 2 years, I haven't been healthy. So if I can be healthy, get back to 17, 18, 19, when I was feeling good.
Where is your health in terms of maybe a percentage of what you think you can do right now?
Yeah, I feel great. I feel very, very good. Every day it gets better and better and, very close to 100%. Everything feels normal. Worked pretty hard on it and, now it's time to go play.
How would you describe the challenges and frustrations of not being 100% yet still trying to go out and be one of the best in the world?
Yeah, it's frustrating. But at the same time, you just got to understand that you're kind of limited and there's only so much you can do, so many hours you can practice, so many balls you can hit. And that's kind of been the MO for a while. It's, limited on balls, limited on things you can do. So nice to kind of open it up where, you can get back to doing what I do.
What did you learn, maybe, I won't say during the downtime, but the time where you couldn't do everything you wanted, maybe about yourself, that would you would approach this differently, you know, with your health certainly in focus?
I think since I've been through the struggle, maybe my golf IQ has gone up quite a bit. Understanding how the process of it, the how things work, and understanding my golf swing a little bit better, how to really get around a golf course. And I think that's been the big difference. So hopefully that kind of rolls over.
What about this golf course this week? How do you attack it?
Yeah, it kind of all depends on this wind. Yesterday there was no wind, and then today it's kind of blowing, you know, 10, 15. So, I mean, you've seen it blow 20, 25 out here, and it can play completely different. Just kind of depends on that, what you're going to see this week.
Brooks, always appreciate the time. All the best this week and this year.
Yep, thanks.
For Brooks Koepka to be successful, you just heard it. It is about feeling healthy, saying he's close to 100%. And that's good news if you're a Brooks Koepka fan. George, you touched on it. All the way down to 16th in the world golf ranking. High aspirations to move back up inside that top 10 throughout the course of the year for Brooks Koepka. Again, health, a big central part of him being successful. And speaking of health, some late news yesterday. Cameron Champ having to withdraw from this tournament, testing positive for COVID. News from his camp saying Champ extremely disappointed not to make it back out to Hawaii, but the good news, they were able to catch the breakthrough case while he was home in Houston. You might remember last summer, Champ had a withdrawal from the Travelers Championship, again, testing positive for COVID. Then we send all our best to Cameron. Hope he gets healthy soon. We'll see him back out here on the PGA Tour, hopefully in the next few weeks, George.
All right, appreciate it. Burko, as the field goes from 39 to now just 38. Teeing it up this week at the Century Tournament of Champions. So Brooks Koepka and what he's done so far this season, 4 starts, a couple missed cuts, pretty blah by Brooks's standards. Where do you think he's at in his career? Is he going to be chasing what was the former high water mark? Or do you think this is just a momentary blip with the injuries and he's going to resurrect and be the Brooks that we saw from 2017 to 19?
Well, the key phrase you just used there, George, was Brooks's standard. And he applies a standard to himself that most people might consider kind of outlandish. If he's not winning majors, the year's a failure. I mean, he was top 8 in 3 majors this year while he was unhealthy by his own description, including on a busted knee at Kiowa. He finished 2nd to Phil Mickelson, and he considers that a failure. And that's part of the problem with Brooks. If you have set that bar as yourself, that that is what constitutes success, then you're going to spend most years of your career coming up short of that. He clearly believes that he has not yet hit his peak. He's 31 years old. I'd be more worried if he did actually think that he had hit his peak at this point, given that he's got so far left to go. I mean, Phil's still winning majors almost at 51 years of age.
Well, I don't think any athlete truly think that.
No, they always believe their best days are... We believe our best days are ahead of us.
Well, yeah, I would hope so.
But he's, you know, he's down to number 16 in the world. To me, the key with Koepka this year isn't so much the health or the on-course performance, because he talked about taking more ownership of his swing. It's how much he's going to be distracted by the sideshow stuff, which we saw a lot of this year with the abandoned match against Dave Portnoy from Barstool Sports. We saw the Bryson feud all year long. He's very easily amused and distracted by stuff that's happening outside the ropes. And I think if he quieted that noise a little bit, then that could only advantage him.
Paige, would love to get your insights here, because you look at players who win majors in bunches, like Nick Price wins yep. 3 in the early to mid-90s. You look at Jordan Spieth from 2015 to 17 wins 3. Rory McIlroy has a stretch where he wins 4 majors from 2011 to 2014. It's hard to win majors when we see guys win a bunch in a short amount of time, then we extrapolate and project that, oh, well, if they do this, they can then get to X in their career. Is this going to be a blip because of injuries? Or is Brooks not going to be the same player that we saw 2, 3, 4 years ago?
It's hard to project, but I do want to comment on what Eamon said as it relates to distractions. I actually don't view some of those things as distractions. I actually view it as fuel. Some people put their goals on sticky notes around the mirror in their bathroom.
I think Brooks Koepka projects his goals in the breathtaking arrogance that he sometimes talks with. But I think that's what feeds him. I think it's those things that help motivate him. If he puts it out there, he's got to go chase it and get it. He's been very successful at doing that throughout the last several years. So I think as long as he stays healthy and he keeps that kind of confidence that he talks with, that he'll continue to do that. I think it will continue to feed and fuel him.
No, I completely agree. And when he won at Bethpage, Brooks was very confident leading into that week that he thought that this was a tournament that he should be the favorite. And if he executed, then he would separate himself from the rest of the field. And he was able to deliver there. I'm curious, though, and Paige, you know, when athletes deal with injuries, their body compensates in ways that subconsciously they may not be aware of. And then that can impact them, not just day-to-day when it comes to repetition, but in high-pressure situations, your body's not going to react the same. And that would be my concern with Brooks going forward, is he had this aura of invincibility. And now, especially the head-to-head with Phil, he's not used to coming up short in what's a very high-leverage situation.
It's a great point, George, that you bring up. There has been an invincibility about him up until the last couple of years. There's been those moments like the PGA where you expected him to be able to rise to the occasion and it didn't happen. So certainly wary of that. Obviously, the health is going to be an issue. But most importantly, when I think about what I've seen from him when he's injured, I think back to the Masters when he couldn't bend down to read a putt and left a lot of people questioning, why come back this soon? Why push yourself when, to your point, George, that can create compensation. I always go back to the athlete. I have to trust that the athlete knows their body better than anybody else. But in that situation, certainly there was potentially some serious compensation going on. And I think Brooks Koepka, as many injuries as he's been through, there's not a player that understands their own body better than the way that Brooks Koepka likely understands his and what it's capable of doing.
Yeah, I think there's the Terminator of old has looked a little more fragile over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. But I also think the flip side of that is look at what he's achieved essentially on crutches by golfer standards. You know, he almost won the PGA Championship. He put himself in a great position on Sunday at Torrey Pines, ended up finishing T4, kind of ran out of holes and steam at the end.
Yeah.
And he was top six at the Open Championship as well, not really in the mix.
Yeah, it's not like he's missing cuts in the majors. Like, he's still...
Yeah, whenever the big events turn around, Brooks Koepka shows up, and it doesn't seem to matter if he's hobbling to the starting line on crutches or if he's walking in like Schwarzenegger in Terminator 30 years ago. He still seems to be able to motivate himself for those kind of tournaments.
So you're saying Brooks will be back?
He doesn't even think he's been away. That's actually the strange thing about it.
All right. Under review, entering 2022, one of my favorite films of all time, Office Space. You got to give the nod there. So whose performance, Eamon, is under review for 22?
How could it not be Dustin Johnson? I mean, here we are at the Tournament of Champions and the world number three isn't eligible. And he hasn't actually won since the Masters in 2020. Well, he won the Saudi International last year, but the field back then was kind of equivalent to an elevated member guest, dismember guest in their case. But there has been a major erosion across Dustin Johnson's entire game in almost every category. It's not dramatic in any particular area, but there's enough of an erosion where he just looks as though he's now a mid-pack player right now on the PGA Tour, despite being number three in the world rankings. And you can throw other guys in there. Obviously, Ricky Fowler is still under tremendous amount of scrutiny, trying to get his game back. He showed signs of life at the CJ Cup in October. He finished tied for third. That was only his second top 10 in 2 years. I would even throw Louis Oosthuizen in there. He almost won several majors.
Bonus ones.
Louis almost won several majors last year. He puts himself in the mix in the biggest events consistently, but he doesn't actually win any of them. And you could make an argument that's, I admit, fairly uncharitable, that Louis has beaten an elite field once in his entire career, which he did at St Andrews in 2010, because his other wins have come on lesser tours. And a guy with that talent, who's that likeable, that even keeled, not to actually be closing more often, I think he's got to be under a little bit of a review as well.
Okay, giving us a threesome there. You're on notice. My player under review, another guy who was able to close at least one big event, and that would be Xander Schauffele winning the gold medal, and what he had to do on the 72nd hole was remarkable. He has so much talent. He's been in so many close positions, situations in majors. Been 3 years, though, since he won on the PGA Tour, so that's stretching back to the Century Tournament of Champions in 2019. So would be curious, and it's not necessarily a negative connotation, but just curious what Xander is capable of in 2022. We know he has a lot of talent. He was an underdog growing up, didn't win a ton in college, had that amazing rookie season and then won four times his first few seasons on the PGA Tour, but then to evolve and take that next step like his buddy Patrick Cantlay was able to do. We think he's capable, but we're not sure if and when we're going to see it.
I think it's, in a way, it's kind of evident. And the same thing with Louis, to an extent. There's this perception that there has to be something missing, that they're not trying hard enough, they don't want it enough. And I don't think that's the case with any of the guys that we've mentioned so far. And I don't think it's a case of a work ethic out there. I think it's just simply evidence of how tough it is to actually win out there on any given week.
It's extremely tough, especially now that you see, I mean, Patrick Cantlay leads the PGA Tour in victories with four. And that was like by a landslide. Like to even get to four is an amazing season versus 5, 10, 15 years ago, especially with what T-Dub was doing. You'd see 6, 7. BJ had a 9-win season back in 2004. It's a completely different landscape. And Beth Ann was saying the same thing on the LPGA Tour. Speaking of the LPGA Tour, Paige, who do you have under review?
I've got Lexi Thompson under review. And I think last year was another one of those seasons where there was more left on the table than what she could say that she accomplished, in that we saw her lose the U.S. Open with a 5-shot lead. We saw the Pelican slip through her fingers at the very end of the season as well. So I think there was so much that was left wanting for Lexi Thompson. Now, what is slightly different than Lexi, than, for example, what Dustin Johnson was, what Eamon pointed out, the slow erosion through parts of his game, that's not been the case for Lexi Thompson. In fact, her strength has actually gotten stronger. She's one of the best ball strikers on the LPGA Tour and has been the majority of her career. But last season, there was something especially good. Take a look at exactly what I'm talking about. Greens and regulation, look at those percentages. All very good. All top five on the LPGA Tour. But last season was the best ever. Nearly 79% of her greens and regulation. What I'm very much looking forward to next season is these KPMG insights, and in particular with Lexi Thompson, because I think she's been a vastly underrated ball striker, even with regards to the number of stats that she has. And I'm curious to see how the putting numbers are going to play out. We did see a great week at Pelican where she was leading the field going into Sunday with her putting statistics, but that's been a hole in her game, and that's what I'm going to be focused on next season. We're seeing, you know, continued strides elsewhere in her game, waiting for that putting to catch up and the short game to catch up to see if she can continue to get back into the winner's circle, which she hasn't been in since 2019.
And then you're still holding your breath down the stretch in the NBA. It's almost like what Sixers fans had to endure with Ben Simmons in the fourth quarter. The Lexi that you see the first 63 holes has been different than the Lexi the final nine, for sure. So many uncertainties for 2022. One thing we know will happen, Eamon, the President's Cup will kick the tires on both the U.S. and international teams, is Hideki Matsuyama. I mean, he was riding high at 21. Masters victory, wins the Zozo. How's he going to top that in 22? And you know he's a stalwart on that team. Abraham Answer has all but punched his ticket to Charlotte for the international team as well, with Captain Trevor Immelman, as you're watching Golf Today. History time. Time to check out this date in golf history. For that, we flash all the way back to, what year is it? Yeah, you guessed it. January 5th, 1994, PGA Tour Commissioner Dean Beaman announcing the PGA Tour is working on developing what would ultimately become the President's Cup. So here are some hopefuls who want to be a part of the 2022 showdown at Quail Hollow, and we're looking at the international side, some of the names that will likely make Trevor Immelman's team. Hideki Matsuyama seems to be a no-brainer. Mark Leishman, Abraham Answer, Gary Kigo, another compelling name who had that win at the Palmetto Championship, just getting settled into life now on the PGA Tour and over in the U.S. Cameron Smith, another notable. So some of the odds in this odds to win presented by PointsBet. Not a huge shock. U.S. a prohibitive favorite, minus 300. So that would be 3-1 odds for the international team to win. A draw, 14-1. I don't know if I'm feeling spice enough to lay down some action on a draw. So, we had a competitive Presidents' Cup in 2019 mm-hmm. at Royal Melbourne. Of course, that was the site of the last international victory in Australia back in 1998. And it had this feeling of momentum, and this could really propel the Presidents' Cup going forward. Do you think this will be a competitive one in Charlotte in 22?
I do, mainly based on venue, because almost everyone who's going to be on that team will be very familiar with Quail Hollow as an annual PGA Tour stop. The President's Cup has actually dislodged the Wells Fargo tournament this time around. And I think this could be a kind of a make-or-break year, in a way, for the President's Cup, because it's always laboured under this perception that it was Ryder Cup light. And, there's been 13 of them. The US has won 11, one tie, one win for the international team. And none of Trevor Immelman's team has any institutional positive memories of the President's Cup. They've all lost. None of the guys who were on that winning team in 1998 still play on the PGA Tour anymore. Stewie Appleby is the youngest at 50. So they have to kind of create a new history for themselves here. And I think when you look at what's happening with Europe and the Ryder Cup team, this perception that they're caught between generations, where the Justin Rose, Lee Westwood generation is kind of aging out of the Ryder Cup. And you're wondering where, Stenson as well, you're wondering where the next younger generation, the generation behind the Rory McIlroys of the world, where they're coming up. It's a plausible argument that the President's Cup may actually develop into the more interesting team event over the next couple of years.
With the European team in the Ryder Cup, we always hear about camaraderie, but it's not like they all share a common language necessarily. Obviously, a lot of them speak English, so it makes it easier, but it's not like they all grew up with the same nationalistic pride as youth. For the international team, do you think it's that much more difficult to create like a cohesive culture with these guys, given just how global it is where they're pulling these guys from instead of being from the same continent in Europe?
I don't think it's different at all. I think the international team is motivated by exactly the same thing as the European team is motivated by, even though they won't say it, it's they just want to beat the Yanks. I think it's literally that simple. And it doesn't matter where they pull them from. The American team is always going to be the sheriff in the room. And there's a certain swagger to American team golf, even in these years over the last 30 years in the Ryder Cup where they haven't earned the right to that swagger, it still exists. And that, I think, is used as fuel by the opposing teams, regardless of what the competition is.
Would there ever be an appetite on the European side to play the internationals?
I don't think so, because that automatically kind of demeans in their mind, I think, their status in the Ryder Cup. They're going to let the Americans tire themselves out with a team competition every year because the Europeans only have to show up every 2 years. But I think it's easy to sort of build up a lot of these guys who are on the international team. And the list that we just saw there, they're all winners in the last year, right down to Garrick Higgo and obviously Hideki with the Masters. But the American team, if you want a sign of how strong the American team is, and I get that we're in the early days of the qualifying here, Dustin Johnson, with two major championships and the world number three, is not actually in the team yet. That's how strong the American squad is.
Wow. I mean, my jaw is barely staying off the desk here. I mean, that's shocking. But you look at the strength of what the Americans were able to bring to Whistling Straits for the Ryder Cup, and just on paper, it's still surprising, but you know the depth that they have at the top and just the stranglehold that they currently have in the top 10 in the world rankings.
They do, and look at the captaincy experience here as well. Trevor played on a couple of international teams and he was the vice-captain for Ernie Els last time at Royal Melbourne. But Davis Love has captained two Ryder Cup teams. He's been a member of many of them. He's served even most recently as vice-captain again. So there's certainly also a depth of experience gap there when you get into the locker room as well. But Trevor Immelman's, I think, could prove himself a pretty formidable opponent for Davis Love.
Yeah, I mean, obviously a colleague of ours, but it's been interesting to see kind of the path of progression and the groundwork that he's been laying years out to then get to this point, not just as a captain, but to instill a type of camaraderie for the potential hopefuls that would comprise the squad that they're going to then ultimately take to Quail Hollow.